Thank you. Thank you. I think we all got our homework to do, so we can all go home and start working on laying the foundation for a better and safer world for us all. Jennifer, I don't know after tonight you would again talk to me. Because you're going to have the hardest task this evening. My job here is to introduce Jennifer, and most of you either are familiar with her voice because of her show Maine Calling on weekdays on Maine Public Broadcasting. And some of you also may remember her face. She used to be on TV, PBS, for years. So we are honored and fortunate to have Jennifer to agree to moderate these. And again, you have almost the most impossible task to do, to have these three wise leaders on task. And I wish you luck. And we still love you. Please respond to my emails and phone calls. Thank you, Jennifer. And now we start the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Raisa. Just if Raisa calls you, sends you an email, think about it before you respond. No, I'm kidding. Anything for you, Raisa Jolly. But one thing that is occurring to me as I listen to all three of you speak and speak so eloquently about the role of your faith and people of your faith in promoting peace in this world and promoting another 50 years in the spirit of the Nostra Aetate, is that we're having this conversation in the state that has the lowest percentage of people of faith of any state in the nation. Many people in Maine not only don't go to church or temple or the mosque or any other religious organization, but many people are actually suspicious of people of faith and believe that people of faith are the problem, that the world wouldn't have these problems if it weren't for religious strife. So instead of the questions that I had scripted, which you have all answered so eloquently, why don't we talk about that in this increasingly secular world? What is the role of your faith traditions in promoting peace as the world changes? And do you want to start, Imam?
Give me a no, no, no. Well, a few things, Jennifer. Number one, I do not really blame those who left religion, because in the three traditions, the clergy have become in so many ways irrelevant. And we focus more, as I said earlier, on dogmas. And the kids are not interested in dogma. Youth are not interested in dogmas. They have challenges, social, political, economic challenges that they have to deal with. And therefore, we, the clergy or religious institutions, have to transform their religious language, have to reintroduce God in a manner that will make God relevant and religion relevant to the masses. This is number one. And that, by the way, takes a lot of courage, because it's easy to depend on the status quo and what has always been. And it's difficult to challenge and say, I want to reform, I want to transform, I want to change. That's number one. Number two, in the case of Islam, I want imams to become the voice of peace, rather than being bought by politicians for political agendas. The best service I can do for Islam, but also I think other religions, in the case of Judaism, in the case of Christianity, where you have political agendas everywhere, in America and overseas, that have bought in and used religion and the clergy for their own political agendas. That's got to change. And therefore, I espouse a full separation between religious institutions and political institutions for the health of both. And we religious institutions and those who lead them should not allow being used or co-opted by politicians. And we have so many examples. I always say, whenever religion and politics marry, we end up with a bad marriage, a very nasty divorce, And God knows what court will solve that divorce. And for me, that's the way to move forward. Number three, the masses, you guys in the field, when you hear your clergy, whether a rabbi, a pastor, an imam, or whatever, monk in any field, when he or she stands on the pulpit and gives you an exclusive language, or teaches you to hate, or teaches you to reject, or tries to use you for political agendas, you have to say, not in my name, I will not allow this, and we don't want you to preach that kind of message. You, the people, have a lot of power. America was founded on this concept of we, the people. And the clergy might be afraid, might not be afraid, might be used by the politics of his or her country or nation, but you have the right to say, I'm tired of that kind of language. I think this will contribute to world peace.
Bishop Kennedy.
Well, this is an issue, of course, that is very important in Catholicism at the present time, both with Pope Francis in his role and with the with what began with Pope Benedict on the notion of new evangelization, and was even much goes back to earlier days with Pope Paul VI right after the Council. And this matter is a way.
I'm going to move your microphone up. I hear people whispering. Saying I can't hear
we turned
him.
It down because we put it down because it was creating other noises. So there is a certain awareness within Catholicism, certainly about the need for being able to establish a new way of talking to people about the mystery of God and the way in which the mystery of that love that comes to us through the expression of the, for us, would be the sacraments and the way in which we participate in a way of life that is structured in such a way that all of the pieces that are related to the introduction to the mystery of God's action in our lives with the baptism. Continued through the strengthening and the confirmation through the other sacraments, Eucharist, confession, and so forth, marriage, priesthood, and even then in death. So we have a way in which our need is to help people discover and help them to discover what is it that is actually undergoing in their lives in relationship to belonging to a mystery that transcends them and yet at the same time is something that is very close to the intimacies of their own hearts. I think that one of the issues that we see happening in the new evangelization is that precisely this way of trying to help people find access to the presence of God within their lives in a way that allows them to be able to articulate them and to find, because one of the things in Catholicism that has always been very important is the development of symbols. Symbols basically are intended to be able to bring to light the depth and dimension of the way in which the experience of God can be recognized and can grow. So that, for example, the way in which our churches are set up is basically, and mostly all of this is true of other Christian churches as well, is that the symbols are really, in a sense, evoking feelings which allow people to have a sense of wonder, a sense of beauty. I mean, I think all of these elements that are so crucial to this awakening of the soul, to the depth of what is present within existence, as the religious communities begin to indicate the way in which charity, for example, becomes itself a symbol for doing something, for sacrificing. The imam is talking about that we all need to come together to do these things. Indeed, we need to do these things because what is necessary is we have to yield to the notion of the selfishness that can be so much a part of the present time, which can block people from having any sense of the transcendent, any sense of God. And so I think that one of the things that's important is that we begin to try to find once again how to awaken people to those experiences that are in their lives that basically can be articulated for them as a way in which, for example, what does it mean to be in love? The matter of being in love is not only a matter that can be a matter of human experience, but being in love can also be being in love with God. And so it isn't so much, I think, from our point of view, that dogmas disappear, but rather that the dogmas contain in within themselves certain kinds of symbols that can be used in a way to reawaken people in a different time. And I think the problem that we face in present Western culture is that we have this continuing, so the secularization that you mentioned, it can be not just a great liberation, it can be a tremendous block on what is truly authentic within the human person. And I think what we're trying to do is to trying to help people to discover this. I think one of the very important things in terms of the interreligious matters, in relationship to this awakening to the mystery of God that is not only something that we're concerned about within the Christian tradition, but also within any other religion. And that is, I think, the importance of, as a symbol, of taking hold of the novels and stories and imaginative expressions of people of other religious traditions, and beginning to see how it is that experiences relate of the connection of their lives to God and the struggles and the difficulties that they face in terms of being able to immediately relate what is a matter of an ultimate meaning to the daily things that go on within their lives. Storytellers are great mediators for awakening the soul to the mystery of divine presence and of the way in which different traditions have been able to name that.
Rabbi Sandmill.
Oh, you want me to answer this one too?
Well, just wondering, you know, in this, again, in a world in which many people around us believe that religion is the problem and not the solution, what do you say? Organized religion.
Well, so here's a cheap line. If you don't like organized religion, come to us. So, I think that the attack on organized religion, I think doesn't go very deep because most human institutions, including religious institutions, are flawed. And to single out religion and organized religion as opposed to, say, organized government, in all seriousness, you know, as something which is no, which has absolutely no use, is as unfair to the positive things that religious institutions can do, given the fact that they're human institutions and flawed by definition, any more than you can say that about government or other things along those lines. I also think we need to take a bit of an historical perspective and understand that religious fervor, at least in the United States, has had periods of growth and periods of contraction. I'm not suggesting that that the linear development of that is necessarily up and down. We certainly are moving towards an age in which people are choosing, especially younger people, are not necessarily choosing to identify themselves with one particular tradition any more than they are choosing to identify themselves with other particularities. Religious institutions tend to be quite conservative and these are generalizations, and tend to resist change. And we are in a world in which communication and travel and concepts of community are changing very quickly. And our religious institutions need to be able to keep up with that. They need to be willing to experiment. They need to be willing to fail in some of those experiments, which is something that most religious institutions are scared to death of. You know, what happens if we do a program and nobody shows up or it does? Well, you learn something from that, right? I think that there is, again, especially if we're talking about the next couple of generations, I think that there is a great appreciation and desire to be involved in activities that help build communities. And so when religious communities can foreground some of those sorts of activities, don't tell my children, but I follow them on Facebook. Just in the last couple of weeks or so.
Is that why you follow me?
You are my brother, not my child.
You also follow your brother.
That too. Oh, my God. But, you know, in the last couple of weeks, the movement with which I'm identified as a Jew, the Reform Movement through the Union of Reform Judaism, at its biennial institution passed one of the most progressive resolutions regarding transgendered people of any religious institution in the country. This is a movement that has... that was the first Jewish movement to ordain women and openly gay men and women as rabbis. This, in and of itself, is not necessarily an answer to these challenges, but I think a willingness to address the challenges of the world, to understand that. Tradition and change can go hand in hand with each other. To circle back again, I believe the church talks about a dialogue of words, the dialogue of life, the dialogue of action, and there's one more in there.
Culture.
Dialogue of culture, okay. So the mission also talks about four kinds all of the time. I think the dialogue of action is extraordinarily important for not only connecting people across traditional lines, but also helping people see within their own traditions. And here, for example, the Interfaith Youth Corps, Eboo Patel's organization out of Chicago. Someone mentioned Habitat for Humanity. I think you talked about soup kitchens as well. That is, there is a deep spirituality that comes from working together to make a difference. And that's a spirituality that I think even people who are not necessarily believers can tap into. So I think you also asked about, you know, religion, the perception of religion as a negative force in the world, and there are certainly plenty of examples that one can hold up for that. I would here also make a small critique of the media that's much more interested in conflict than heartwarming stories about people working together. Of course, Maine Public Broadcasting is an exception to this.
Thank you.
I stream it at home from time to time, in all seriousness. But you know the you know, how many How many multiples of people have watched some of the disturbing videos that were posted on the internet by ISIL or ISIS? And I don't mean to single them out, but I'm, you know, in terms of what captures the imagination and what gets the attention is the violence. If we want to go to Israel and Palestine, what gets on the news is the violence. Very rarely are you going to have a report about Israeli Jews and Palestinians who are working on cooperative projects together, on dialogue together. That doesn't get the attention. And so what we end up with, again, not wishing to diminish for a moment the challenges and the problems that what I would refer to as the abuse of religion brings to the world, but I think that we get a distorted view of the balance.
I want to invite the audience to come to the microphones and ask questions of your own. It's getting late, and I definitely want people to have a chance, but I'll ask one more before we get to people who come up there, and that is, you mentioned Facebook, and I think that's a really terrific thing to bring up tonight, 50 years after Nostra Aetate, when 50 years ago a parish priest could speak to a congregation, a large congregation, a church that was packed to the gills, and that those parishioners would go out and be influenced by that. Today, I'm going to gamble that there are more people on Facebook any given Sunday morning than in their Catholic church or in their other house of worship. How do you counter then these images of violence? How do you use social media as you said, Bishop, that the next 50 years are going to be even more important than the first 50 years? How do we use the tools of the day to facilitate that change?
Yeah, this is we bring up a very important issue. I think that, one of the things that religions are always dealing with in terms of, let's say, what I would call a primary symbol is language. And the way in which language now is transmitted is so different from, because of technologies. The difficulty, and I can remember back in the 1960s, when the questions of technology were becoming very serious cultural questions for many of the philosophers in Western Europe, Heidegger and Gadamer and others. And the question of technology is complicated because of the fact that it is already an extrinsicism. And the problem with religion is that it is not, first of all, an extrinsicism. It is a matter of the interiority of both heart, mind, and imagination. And I think that how we do this is something that we have to work this out, because I don't think yet we have a clear understanding of how we can mediate what is of such depth of the inner self through technologies which immediately make it an external thing.
You work with the students all day, Mom. How do you use
I wanna
social
ask
media?
Before that, I want to say religion is what religion does. Religion also produced Mother Teresa. Religion also produced the concept of the algebra that Muslims produced. Judaism has done a lot for human civilization too. So religion is what religion does. The problem is not in religion, but rather in how we interpret religion. The problem and the crisis is in the minds of people, not in the religious texts themselves, and how we interpret those religious texts, and how we make them become inclusive and relevant and universal. Now, because of what's happening in Syria and Iraq, I work with my Muslim students at Georgetown University to produce 15 to 20 seconds YouTube messages to people in the region, especially to youth. And the impact of those 15 to 20 second messages was beyond imaginations. As I travel to the Arab and Muslim world, I hear people saying, well, I was on my way to Syria, but when I saw your 15 Twitter message or YouTube message, you made me change.
What do the messages say?
Things, what Islam really teaches.
Louder, please.
The mic. The messages were what Islam really teach about peace and love your neighbor, care for others, stand up for the oppressed, things of that sort. And I know this. A few years ago, when there was a debate in Afghanistan, in the parliament of Afghanistan, on the issue of stoning, it was our YouTube messages, one-minute YouTube messages, that forced the Afghani parliament to stop the practice and legislate against the practice of stoning. It was those social media messages and the impact of them on the ground.
Rabbi Sandel, have thoughts on social media in the next 50 years?
Well, if religion is as religion does, I would also say social media is as social media does.
Of course.
One of the strengths, I think, of social media is that, and let's hope that it stays this way, it is a democratic, with a small d, platform. And it is not a hierarchical platform. So that people do not have to go through their leaders necessarily to reach an audience. And that has both positive and negative consequences. But also, the social media and the internet does not stop at borders. And so some of the most exciting things that I have seen have been the ability for people who never would have had the opportunity to communicate with one another to be able to do so in an unmediated fashion. Admittedly, my Facebook feed is tailored to my interests and to my communities, the communities in which I am involved. The positive and uplifting things that come through my feed are not necessarily the things that I'm going to encounter through the mainstream media. And the connections that are made, again, are connections that are not limited by whom I'm able to actually meet face to face or talk to in a very short, within the limitations of sort of space and time, in a sense. We also know that there's the potential for abuse is there. I am, to quote one of the prophets, a prisoner of hope. It's one of my favorite lines in the prophets. And so I think that the desire for community, writ small and writ large. We haven't talked a lot this evening. We did actually this morning this afternoon with the high school students. We haven't talked a lot about the environment and the fact that, it's the story of the three people who are out in the boat, and one of them starts to drill a hole in the floor of the boat and says, "What are you going to do? We're all going to drown." This is not my problem. This is my part of the boat. It doesn't affect you, right? We are all on this very small ship that is sinking. And we need to bring together all of the resources from not only our three traditions, but all of the traditions and all of the people who don't ascribe to any tradition, if we are going to not end up making ourselves extinct. And here I would say that one of the things that so moved me about Pope Francis's encyclical on the environment was that he didn't touch only on science and environmental degradation, but on the connection between environmental degradation and social and economic justice. These are closely integrated. These are things that I think, I come from a religious studies background and an academic background, and I know you don't say all of anything, but it's hard for me to imagine that the vast majority of religious and spiritual traditions don't share that concern for the planet, that concern for the justice, for justice, and that concern for those who are weak and on the margins, who deserve dignity and safety. And ultimately, I am answering your question, really. Ultimately, I think that technology and social media can and will play a crucial role in bringing people together around those issues.
Why don't we start over here?
Arthur Fink from Peaks Island. Is mic on? Well, I can speak up.
Now we can hear you.
Underlying this whole discussion for me is a question: how can we learn to see and hear what's really going on rather than what we expect with all our prejudice? I remember once bringing a junior associate to a wonderful restaurant in a little town in Holland, and when he came back from the bathroom, all he could say at the top of his lungs so that everybody in the restaurant could hear was, you know, they don't even have hot water in the bathroom here. He could not see the gifts on our table and every table. And I wonder what will help us see the gifts around us in different religious practices and beliefs and cultural forms as gifts rather than deviations from what we think is the norm, the way we have always done it. Because I fear that that's the root of reinforcing our prejudice, that we're right, they're different, and they're wrong, without sometimes even noticing the colors of all those flowers in the Iman's garden and seeing them as flowers rather than as weeds.
Any thoughts other than here?
one thought, and that is, is it Robert Putnam who wrote Amazing American Grace? You know, one of the points that he makes in that book in terms of the changes in acceptance in American culture of people from different traditions has to do with getting to know an individual. And he talks about the Thanksgiving dinner table, the family Thanksgiving dinner table, which in most families is becoming more and more diverse. So the other, or the religious other, is no longer someone around the world or in a different part of the country or the city whom you never know and never get to talk to, but it's your Aunt Sally who brought the candied yams. And all of a sudden, that distant, amorphous other becomes someone who's important to you in your lives, in your life. And then when you start to hear some of the negative things that you were saying that we all need to stand up and respond to, we stand up and respond to it perhaps a little bit more when it's not merely theoretical, but when it touches someone we know. So that's just one, the more that we become a planetary village and that we have populations moving and become more diverse, that diversity can bring knowledge and intimacy that can put a human face and a human heart on what used to be that distant, sort of unknown, undifferentiated other.
Bonnie?
Excuse me, I just want to say, I know people are wants to come, we're going to be sponsoring at Temple Bethel from 6 to 8 to give feedback on this and just to continue the discussion at a very late level. So I wanted to get that plug in before people started to leave, and hopefully we'll have energy for a lot more questions. So thank you.
There's a sign-up sheet out back.
Oh, yep, out front when you leave. There's a sign-up sheet and there's flyers with information, and I hope you all come.
Go ahead.
I'm Bonnie Rodden. I'm a board member of the Maine Council of Churches. And my question concerns our governor. And at times he says things that are pretty terrible and hurtful. And he says he cares about the poor and the elderly. What I'm asking of you is, what suggestions do you have about getting him to understand the broader concerns of immigrants and the basic elements that really contribute to these problems? So what you're talking about, the concern for the environment, social justice, economic justice, the roots of the problems that we have today. We haven't had a whole lot of luck with him. And so I'm asking you, what suggestions do you have to deal with him? Dialogue, you know, and beyond dialogue. What do you think will work?
None of us votes in Maine.
Bonnie, do you think, though, that you could expand that, in fact, to anybody who's on the political stage right now whose message seems anti-immigrant or seems to be using stereotypes to gain political gain? I don't want to...
No, that's fair.
Well, I said earlier, the power of the people, we the people. Imagine an ex-candidate coming to Maine to campaign. And because of his or her stance, no one goes to that guy. That's a stand, and that helps. At the end of the day, these politicians are after votes, and they need to know that we, the people, do not give in to their agenda, and we want a different vote, a different voice, a different message. We, the people. For me, that's the suggestion. We believe in ourselves and our ability to change these politicians by voting them out or in.
But there is a problem, I mean, in the sense that there will be people who will be in favor of some of these policies that we, you and I may say we're not, this isn't something that we find an acceptable way to proceed. And I think the difficulty lies in large measure with the way in which the movement by which people advance into positions of power without being called to be responsible for the kinds of things that people really want them to address as things are emerging. I think the problem, I mean, for example, the Catholic Church has been working on the issue of immigration since the First World War. I mean, we were the first institution that actually the government turned to take care of the immigrants coming in after the First World War. And we still are engaged in this. I think that, and the bishops are constantly giving, saying things out to the people about these things and teaching about these matters. And so it isn't, I think, that there's a silence regarding the kinds of troubles that we face. But I do think that, and I think this goes back to the first question, the problem is oftentimes the horizon or the point of view in which we are posing the kinds of issues that we're making are part of the way in which we shape ourselves and our government and our culture. And so I think it's one of the things that's really important for us is to be engaged at much earlier times than when it comes time for a particular vote. It has to be a participatory and committed engagement in which people have to make sacrifices again in order to make the community become transformed.
Go ahead, sir.
My name is Dick Springer. I'm from Scarborough. I have to say I was somewhat disturbed by some of the response to Jennifer Rook's observations about the large number of non-believers or secularists in Maine. I was raised as a Protestant Christian, and as I reflected on things and in the course of maturing and thinking, I realized that I was not a believer, and I have reasons. I don't want to go through my evolution, but I think I have good reasons for my position. It's in no sense motivated by hostility toward religion or religious institutions, but I have a feeling that quite a bit of the response talked as if that were the case, and I think I and people who think like me should be seen in another way than as potential for being brought back to God or whatever, and we should be treated with the same respect that the different religions represented here are being treated here. I mean, for example, it's as if I'm a potential convert. Now, conversion by Christians, I know, is a very sensitive issue for Jews for very good historic reasons, and nobody here would think of that. So a question is, why do you apparently see me as that way? And I'm referring particularly to what the bishop said.
Which thing did I say? I didn't quite hear what the, what was it that I said that I was?
Can you clarify?
Your response, Bishop, to the discussion of the large number of secular people in Maine was to talk about informing them about God and the mystery and so on in what seemed to me an effort at conversion. Now, you certainly would not approach the rabbi the same way. Why do you feel that it's appropriate to approach non-believers that way rather than treat us with the respect that you treat other religious traditions here?
Yeah, well, I certainly would treat you with the same respect. The thing I was talking about was what I think I was saying was awakening people to the sense of mystery. That's the thing that the question was, how do we respond to the situation now in terms of the way in which the secular culture exists? I think it isn't a matter of not having respect, but it's a way of trying to be able to articulate for ourselves and for all others a way in which we have a sense of the way in which the mystery that we find is something that we might want to be able to tell other people about, but it's certainly not intended as a form of disrespect.
Okay. Well, I'll just say one more thing. You can express your views. I have a sense that you are treating me differently, for example, from the way you would treat the rabbi who has religious differences with you, just because I'm a non-believer.
We're going to move on. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm a student at USM, and my question is that we have three different major religions up here, and I think my view or my concern is that I think we're letting extremists of all sorts, from Christianity, Islam, Judaism, pit us all together, and that I know what you guys are doing is really beautiful, but my question is, how do we combat or how do we fight extremists of all sorts instead of letting the media target one extremist that we should fight, but how do we fight the other, all three extremists again?
Well, I'm not sure that I have a specific answer to that, although what I would like to say is that, if we're talking about Christian extremists, Jewish extremists, Muslim extremists, let's keep in mind that the noun there is extremist, right? And I've been thinking about terminology for this, because terminology is very tricky here, and you made this point earlier today about the phrase Islamic extremist. Violent extremist. You know, I could probably deal with a nonviolent extremist. I think it's a very challenging question. It's a challenging question because who can get the attention of the extremist? Who is it who can reach the extremist, regardless of what community they come from? Speaking very personally, I come from the liberal progressive end of the Jewish spectrum. The Jewish violent religious extremist is not going to listen to me, right? I'm going to be dismissed out of hand. So how do we form those coalitions within our own communities where we can reach those who might have some credibility of offering a different vision, of offering a critique, but of even offering something that's going to be heard? Another term that comes to my mind is absolutism, right? Many of the folks that the questioner asked about are absolutists. And those are folks who are also very difficult to speak to. Now, one thing to do is, I think, to not to flatten out this extremism into something that is monodimensional, that has to do with a very fervent kind of faith, but to understand that nobody exists within a vacuum, that everybody is affected by the cultural and political currents in the world, and that there are times when violent extremism is a response, not an appropriate or an acceptable response, but is a response to despair. The absolutist violent extremist is also created in the image of God and is also a person who has hopes and dreams and needs and often legitimate concerns. And so, as tough as it may be for someone like me, coming from where I come from, to attempt to understand who that person is, that's also a challenge. So, that doesn't seem like a full answer, but I threw that out too.
I want to advise you to read a book called The Theft of Islam, subtitle, Wrestling Islam from Extremists, written by Professor Khalid Abulfadl, who teaches constitutional law at UCLA. A good book in which Professor Abulfadl speaks about what led to extremism in the name of Islam in the Muslim world, and what can be done to reclaim Islam from the extremists. It's really a good book. But I really want to second what the rabbi said. Not that we accept those violent extremists as legitimate, but at the end of the day, some of them are a response to specific social, political challenges and realities. And therefore, to downplay it, we need to respond to those challenges that led to those kinds of extremist views. We need to bring peace and democracy to Syria. We need to bring peace and democracy to Iraq. We need to bring peace and democracy to North Africa, to Egypt. The more of that we do, the less extremism will be, and the less violent extremism there will be, because these people are thriving on dictatorship and its existence. They are thriving on racism and wars. And America, by the way, is a partner in the making of the problem, but it can also be a partner in the making of the solution and crafting that solution. We are all partners in it. We cannot only accuse the Muslim world having produced that extremism, because America has contributed to it in different ways. And we shall not point fingers at each other. And therefore, I say we're all partners in the crafting of that solution. The last thing is, the moderate voice has to speak loud, louder and louder and louder, and we must tell again Fox News, enough is enough.
Go ahead.
My name is Fernanda Darrow from Falmouth, Maine. And I was one of the lucky ones that went to visit Pope Francis in Philadelphia. The message from the Pope was joy, mercy, and encounter. And I couldn't help hearing the three of you when you talked, imagining the three of you talking about those three things, joy, mercy, and encounter. Well, I don't have to imagine. You can humor me and talk right now, just in a few words, what it is to you, joy, mercy, and encounter.
Well, first, I think in the way in which Pope Francis is speaking about this is basically in relationship to his own experience of God. And so therefore, his vision is that when there is a relationship with God, and he speaks frequently of this sense of the presence of Jesus, that there is then the sense of fulfillment, which is what joy brings. It is the sense of peace in which there is an unfolding of a meaning of life that is welcome and which is one wishes to share. And so I think that the way in which he sees this is through the experience of the religious experience of his own life, and he invites others to experience this as well.
Either of you have thoughts?
One sentence. We need to espouse a culture of passion for compassion. That is what the Pope came with. That's what religions all teach. And for me, that is what I ask all of you to do. Espouse a culture of passion for compassion, passionately involved in compassion for all, not only people, but for God's creation, including our Mother Earth.
So the first time that I met Imam Hendi was at an iftar in a mosque in Chicago. Talk about encounter. And I was not there as an individual. I was there with a group from the Jewish community. This mosque reached out and invited us in to experience their joy, to share in their joy, to attempt to appreciate what both the fast and the daily breaking of the fast meant to them. I think the way that mercy fits in there is that without understanding the concept of mercy, which, by the way, is another name of God, I don't think that that invitation would have been offered, and I don't think that it would have been accepted. So for me, it's a joy to be here this evening with my colleagues in this encounter. And if part of what we have attempted to, each in our own way, to underscore is the way that mercy needs to push hatred and preconceptions and prejudice out of the way. So that would...
You know, in the Quran, there are 114 chapters. And 113 of them start with Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of God, the merciful, the compassionate. And we say in our teaching of the Quran that no matter what you are learning in the Quran, it's about mercy and compassion.
Thank you.
Over here, go ahead.
Hello, I'm a student from St. Joseph's College. I've been hearing a lot about Vatican II and other Catholic doctrine that have allowed these kind of dialogues to take place. I was wondering, why do you think it took the Catholic doctrine to change slightly in order to allow these talks to take place? And do you think these talks would start taking place if they had not happened at all?
Go ahead. Well,
you know, the thing is that at least in terms of certain, you can go back to the first Parliament of the World's Religions in 1893 in Chicago, for example, even before that, to see some of the beginnings of contemporary modern interfaith relations. But I think, as I mentioned earlier, that the reality of the Second World War, both with the Nazi Final Solution, which we should point out targeted not only Jews, but also Roma and Sinti people, gays and lesbians. There were plenty of Catholics and plenty of priests who were targeted by the Nazis, as well as, again, in a very different way, but the use of atomic weapons at Nagasaki and Hiroshima. I think that after the Second World War, the world as a whole was in shock at what had happened in the world. I think that there were a number of forces that brought the second that brought the Catholic Church that brought John the 23rd to convene the Second Vatican Council. But I think in terms of its effect, and here I'm going to move from the sublime to the mundane, and that is that the Second Vatican Council was in its day a media event, right? There were reporters following it. It was a big deal. And when the Vatican makes a statement, and when a pope makes a statement, the world pays attention. So even if the church wasn't necessarily the first to start talking about rethinking Christian relations with Jews and Judaism, because of its place in the world and the attention paid to it, and again, as I mentioned earlier, the subsequent work that it has been done, I think that's the reason why it had such a significant effect on the world. I don't know.
That's true. In fact, I would say it even goes back to the First World War. So it's not just the Second World War, but because the Great War was the one in which the sense of what Europe was and the notion that there was going to be continual progress came to an end. And so it was a question of what are the fundamental roots that we have to return to if we're going to be able to have a world in which we can begin to think about the possibilities of peace, and then how is that going to be able to be done in relationship to our conversations, not only politically, but also religiously with one another.
I'm sorry to cut you off. I got one of these a few moments ago, and I tried to string it out. And so I think we've been together all day, and we're all growing a little bit tired. So what I would say is I think the formal part of this we're going to bring to a close. I can't thank you enough for coming tonight. I know we are looking forward to continuing dialogue into the future. We have a sign-up sheet out there for a dinner dialogue. And the gentleman will probably be around for a little bit for questions, but we're going to have to bring the formal piece to an end. So thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.